Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome, Steve, to another edition of Book Lovers Wairarapa.
Very good.
It is. I got that. I'm Gareth Raps, and I'm here with co-host Steve Lawrence. This is our one-hour program, the October edition, the special edition. It's so important, about the world of books, and you've found us on Arrow FM, and you can watch us on Channel 41 on Wairarapa Freeview TV. But Steve, it's all about tonight.
Right. So we normally start with the Wairarapa word, and with a sense of urgency, because our desperate desire to have our events on the first Sunday of the month, which worked for a couple of months, was cast asunder because we have a bit of a joint venture with Headley's Books and Yarns and Barns. So last 2 years ago, we did a joint event with Charity Norman and her book Remember Me. And tonight, we have Christina Sanders coming to the Carterton Courthouse at 7:30 to talk about her book, O Kiwi Brown. Now, we've talked about O Kiwi Brown before. It's her third work of historical New Zealand fiction after Jerningham and Mrs. Stuhl and the Wreck of the General Grant. So she'll be in conversation with Mary McCullum from Cuba Press. Now, Mary's her publisher.
Right.
So that should be, I think, a really interesting discussion for people who are interested in New Zealand history, historical fiction, yeah, and how the book world works. So that's tonight.
And going by the beautiful afternoon we're experiencing, it should be a terrific night to actually take a stroll into the courthouse.
Yeah, you shouldn't need your brolly.
No. And that's Yarns and Barns. That's been going now for a couple of this week.
This is the second week, yeah. Runs to, I think, towards the end of this week, which is why we're on the 22nd of the month to fit in with what David's schedule as to when he can.
No, and it's another example of terrific booky things that happen up and down the valley. And
Because we're only week and a half after the Wairarapa Book Hop, organised by your friend and mine now, Millie Blackwell. Really, Millie does all the work. Thanks to Millie. And we had hundreds of people cruising around the bookshops, really busy.
Right. And in the bookshop this afternoon, there's some terrific new stock, which we've got a sample to show a lot of you today. Yeah. But an exciting time. Boxes are arriving and, the best part of the job, opening them up and seeing what is in front of you.
Yeah, thinking, what the hell was I thinking when I ordered that?
I know.
Whose idea was to get 100 of those?
Yeah.
Not that I've done that.
Glancing ahead in Y Word, there's the November edition on, and then we talked a little bit about research.
Now, yeah, so that's the thrust of it. We've got a couple of Wairarapa writers coming along to talk about the research they've done for their books. Di Grant's coming to talk about the work she put into The South of Martinborough, which is a non-fiction sort of book of Martinborough sort of things. And so that's on will be the first Sunday, the 3rd of November, I think at 4 o'clock in the courthouse.
Yeah. And, hey, any wannabe author just needs to know, actually, the craft of research and how do you generate your ideas and the shape of your book and how do you get to know to pick what is really salient and, research is a terrific topic and, it is it's an essential component of getting a good book out there. That could get quite an audience.
I think so, from people who are, particularly people who are interested in going on to do something or in the middle of working on something, you get
and a chance to pick their brains and ask the questions. Yeah, excellent. Well, let's just start moving on. Now, I've got looking at the books over on this side of the table. I've got a little bit of the art thing. I've got a couple of novels and a couple of general non-fictions. And I notice you have a very impressive pile there. So let's jump in. Mm-hmm. The art things, we can cut these two out pretty quickly. Things to look forward to in 52 Large and Small Joys for Today and Every Day by Sophie Blackwell. Now, Sophie is an Australian illustrator and has won, is it the Caldecott Awards for Hello Lighthouse and Finding Winnie, which are
That's for illustrating children's books, I think, the Caldecott.
Right. And this is a sort of a COVID-y book, I think. You know, COVID, we can thank COVID for a lot of things where people had time to, you know, sit and generate one and to think, what do you actually, when you wake up, what is interesting to look forward to? And why I like this book, actually, is that, A, she's a terrific illustrator, so you get a simple idea of coffee, mm-hmm. A paragraph, and a great little picture. That's not beyond all of us, but with Sophie, it's always something special. So, I mean, she would start like the sun coming up. I mean, it'll be dark when the day that doesn't come up. So it's, you know, and people actually talk about being up to see the sunrise, and coffee and a hot shower and baking something for somebody, learning something new, a new word. It goes on and on. Terrifically fun book, but it does get, what the gift of this book for me was, that it made me sit down and go, well, actually, what do I look forward to in a day? Hmm. And so I created a big chart, not the spreadsheet, but just on a bit of paper, I took a few ideas from this, and then you start to think of all the things that happen on a typical day. Things that you might look forward to, Steve?
Now we've got three dogs at home. I quite enjoy going home and being molested by them because they get quite competitive for a
right,
pet.
You're going to give me three things that you look forward to. So the dogs and interacting with them.
And I better mention Debbie.
It's always, our partners are always, they're always something to look forward to. I mean, and also, getting the list of, things not to forget is always important. And one other thing that you might look forward to in the day.
Well, I do, now that the troops at the cafe have got used to me, I get an Americano on arrival.
Everybody should have a cafe in their business,
I don't think they should.
No, I like it. I think it actually adds a whole dimension to your business. Mm. And often, if you come in, especially in the morning, the buzz is, it absolutely is, I think, very welcoming. And anyway, moving on. Second one is an art book, Gretchen Olbrich. Now, I'm picking you one. I won't find this, perhaps, on your shelves. But what I did notice you had Ewan McDonald's, is it, book Look Up?
Yeah.
So I'm really pleased, as somebody who's interested in art books, that you have art books.
Yes, we do.
But this one, I mean, Gretchen, born 1943, and she is our great abstract painter. And, she started off figurative, at Ilam, went to Mount Ross School, and even with a name like Gretchen Olbrich, and went then into Ilam School of Arts, figurative painter, but quickly moved into abstraction, which is a tough ask for people to get into and buy and support. But she's had a lifetime of it. Worked in Dunedin, the States, London, now, operates out of London and Auckland, and sort of has been compared to Mark Rothko. But she's known for, and the book is full of, and it's written by a guy, Luke Smyth, who apparently in art circles is very good, a Melbourne writer. But she does these overloid, what they call overloid.
You showed me about 20 of them. There's a certain, what's the word I'm searching for?
I know. The thing is.
What I'm saying to say, don't you? They all look the same to me.
And you tend to end up flicking through them. But here's what interests me. Like, you suddenly find.
Show the people what we're talking about if you can.
Okay.
They're on every page, so
yeah. So here we go. So like you get these now, and they look kind of ordinary, but they're also suddenly they show someone like one of these behind a desk, and it's absolutely sensational. And these can be quite small, and they can be huge, like half the size of this table. You know, imagine chopping this table in half. So they can be big. And she says here that the friend who makes the stretchers for the canvas, their works of art, the actual wooden parts of it all. Anyway, she's won the Companion of New Zealand Order of Merit, so she's been recognised for that. And any artist would absolutely love to have a book, you know, where her work is written about in a kind and caring and supportive way, and beautifully illustrated, 280 photos of her work. And for someone interested like myself, who's kind of interested in abstraction, I thought this was like a real good book, but hard to find,
and pretty hard to sell,
and hard to sell, I imagine. But we aim to please on Book Lovers Rawarapa, and so art we started with. How about over on your side?
Well, we've got all sorts of things. Well, I thought I'd talk about Bill Bailey first. I was surprised that you don't know who he is.
Well, I know he's in the song.
Don't You Come Home, Bill Bailey.
Yeah.
I think that's a different Bill Bailey. Although he is quite musical, Bill. It's part of his act.
And Bill, we had our runner.
We did.
Bronze medal.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, he was with
Marathon.
Early days of Snell in the Lydiard School.
I've met him.
Yeah.
I met him in a good circumstances. Canoeing down the Whanganui River, and we pulled in to camp for the night, and there was a huge fire, and people were sitting around the big campfire, and I was sitting beside Bill.
Oh.
And he introduced himself. And
he'd probably run there from Auckland, had he?
Well, he looked in great nick, but he actually was driving a taxi in Auckland, was his sort of how he was making a dollar, but we had a great evening talking about the great races and the Olympics and Lydiard and all with the boys. Terrifically engaging Bill Bailey. But tell me, this is another Bill Bailey.
This is another Bill Bailey. So Bill is a comedian, has been for a long time. He's done some TV here. Probably most known to New Zealand audiences as being on the QI panel nearly as often as Alan Davis.
But that's for really sharp, clever, intelligent.
You can't just be reading jokes off the auto cue. You've got to. He's a smart guy. I just thought I'd read you a couple of little bits because what he's done here, he's written. It's sort of a memoir. It's called here "My Animals and Other Animals," a memoir of sorts. So it's kind of his life and animals, and he talks about Australia, where he spends a bit of time, in terms of whale sharks. And the first thing he talks about is his first gig in Australia. He went to the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and no one knew who I was. And that can be a bit messy because the people who come to your show, they're just not sure. And he said, on opening night, I was nervous. The room was nearly full, which meant an audience of around 80 people. These early gigs were usually a good signifier of how the whole week might run. A middle-aged couple who were sat directly in the front two seats looked bemused for most of the opening 10 minutes. Not hostile, just wearing a look of mild befuddlement. After about 10 minutes, the couple conferred quietly, then made to get up and shuffled along the front row to leave. In a small room like that, there was no concealing it. A walk out in the first 10 minutes and on my opening night, not good for confidence. Couldn't let the incident pass without comment, so as they shuffled sideways with their coats, I mumbled, "Was it something I said?" The bloke smiled back at me with typical Australian openness. "Oh, no, mate, yeah, nah. We thought you were the juggler." But I'll read you this last paragraph as well, which is different. It says, he's talking about whale sharks because he spent some time scuba diving with whale sharks. Said when they said, the guys on the boat said, "There's a big hammerhead over there as well. Do you want to get back in?" He said, "Oh, I don't think so." Anyway.
Hold on, a whale shark?
Whale shark. There's the biggest critter in the sea apart from a proper whale. So it's a shark, but these things are like, I'll tell you here. "These ancient titans cruise the planet's oceans alone for the durations of their long lifespans, which can be as much as 130 years. To us, this seems like a desperately lonely existence, but this isn't just our own projection. Not having the faculty for self-awareness, they're just swimming along, swishing their tails, living their lives, consumed only by the moment. I felt drawn to whale sharks, their strangeness and beauty, these mysterious ancient souls roaming the seas. For not only are they almost always solitary, as the sole surviving member of the Rhynchodon genus, they are in every sense the last of their kind. So that's kind of...
Yeah. And this is a chapter about different animals.
Different animals, yeah. Dogs, birds, the rabbit and the fox, all sorts of stuff. Cats. But that's stuff they've had in their lives. And
so if he's as entertaining as he on television, then yeah. that could be a good read.
Well, I think...
You've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I have. And it's just one of those things, you know, 15 pages at a time or 10 pages at a time. You don't have to read the book.
And you can bring a smile to your face, which is... Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's one of my recommendations for Christmas for people who want to buy someone a book for someone who doesn't actually read that much.
Excellent. Well, look, I've made a note of that one. But I notice you have another book to do with animals over there.
I do. This is another work of non-fiction by Marcus Zuzak, whose big book was The Book Thief, and he's written some other...
Wonderful book.
So he's an Australian writer. This is a work of non-fiction about... Okay. What it says here. What happens when the Zuzaks open their family home to three big, wild, pound-hardened dogs? Reuben, a wolf at your door with a hacksaw. Archer, blonde, beautiful, deadly. And the rancorously smiling Frosty, who walks like a rolling thunderstorm. So, nicely written story.
A great cover, too.
Yeah, it is, eh? Three wild dogs. So, again...
Being a owner of how many dogs?
Three.
I can see the match. Yeah. I can see why you're drawn to, you know, this book.
Yeah. We didn't get all three at once from a pound, though. I think it would be...
That sounds challenging. Sounds, you know, like one, but three? I mean, they provide company for each other, but...
And you definitely get the pack thing going.
You do.
Especially if someone... enough to come to the door.
With the form of a great book, then it actually is. It's encouraging to give it another shot and say, "Well, all right. I mean, he is Australian, but let's perhaps
give him." There are Australians who can write pretty well. Tom Keneally.
Here we go.
Dalton.
Moving on. The
Perry. There's a few.
Now here's a book I really liked. Oliver Berkman. Now, he wrote a book. Where I came across Oliver Berkman was in the Guardian Weekly, which is a little magazine that a mate gives me. And he had a column called "This Column Will Change Your Life." It was in the sort of culture section at the back.
There's no pretensions about
it. I know. And he writes about the problem of having a column like that because the pressure is. You know, every week to produce, you know,
self-imposed,
yeah. Anyway, he wrote that column and then stopped and turned his way to books. And his first book was 4,000 Weeks, which I think we talked about in the past, being about if you live in the normal life of, say, 75 years or so, you would live 4,000 weeks.
Yep.
And he even had a chart in the book where you could circle each week, you know, like they have all the years and then 52 dots and all that sort of business, which can seem like a lot.
Or put crosses on them if they weren't much good.
Which I enjoyed that book. And it was like, you know, hey, you know, time's ticking and all that sort of stuff. But then he had this latest one is Meditations for Mortals. And his sort of premise is that let's embrace the idea of imperfectness.
Imperfection, I would think.
Imperfection.
Aggressiveness.
No, imperfection, with an ism at it. Seeing our limitations in it. It's sort of like let things happen, don't make things happen type of feeling on it. And it reflects anyway on philosophy and religion and literature and psychology and self-help. What's really good is that he reads all those books, which I'm kind of interested in, and then just picks the best bits out and reports it in books like that. I mean, what's not to like?
Well, that's like a Reader's Digest condensed novel, isn't it?
It is.
They just put every 20th word in because they've cut out all the adjectives.
Right, and it's not familiar advice.
Yeah. yeah.
that you may find being a bit of a sort of like a, like the odd self-help book. I find that I found this, you know, nicely different. Now his suggestion is like this is a 4-week program and you read it, you know, like that, which, you know, I totally ignored and gulped it down in like 3 or 4 days because it is a quick read. Engaging, reassuring, useful, but some of the key takeaways, he goes, there's always too much to do. Accept this. Just relax with that. It's, you know, the future's always out of control, but bold, imperfect action works. So try things, but don't try and do it, you know, necessarily, you know, incredibly time-consuming, thoughtfully thinking of everything. Just give an imperfect sort of thrust into it. That works better.
What do I say? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Perfect. Look, I mean, that's just the sort of thing.
Yeah.
In fact, it's in here, I'm sure.
No, it probably will be, because that's not an original thought.
And he had a neat little metaphor, like, you know, we can live like life like it can either be like kayaks or super yachts. And often we want to be on super yachts, which are, you know, have big nav nets and they're big, and it's sort of you take it out, not like the Belizean one, the one that sunk.
I was going to say, yeah, they can still sink and drown multi-billionaires.
But, you know, with your crew and all, and everything is ordered and under control and it's exact and all that. We want to live a little bit like that. But in fact, life, he goes, is like being in a kayak in a pretty rough river and you're going down and...
And in the end, it's more fun.
And it's more fun, but it's also a little out of control.
Yeah.
Because life is imperfect. But he had a good chapter on reading. Now, we're the book guys, so I thought, well, you know, I even marked that, which I don't really need to have marked anymore. It's a modern problem, reading, as we know. We have piles of books. You have piles of books. I have piles of books. We probably have digital bookmarks on a few things that, you know, we may get round to reading or would like to read. There are podcasts of books or podcasts that we, you know, get into. There were also our viewing of, you know, and when we talk, it's more like Y Word here. We're looking, the words wash over us with our TV viewing. There are people amongst us who game away social media. And it's kind of like filter failure. You know, we're like, how do you get to the good stuff? And his argument is the good stuff is limitless. There's a lot of good stuff. And it's very, very challenging. And he had another metaphor, like, it's like a needle in a haystack where the whole haystack is made of needles. And, you know, you're trying to find even the best of all those needles.
Some of it, there's something good about everything. Everything that's been published, someone thought it was worth doing. And sometimes it's the professional editors and professional...
who know a lot, who are good, yeah.
Yeah. So, and sometimes you have to look pretty hard to find out what that reason was, but it'll be there somewhere.
It will be. We could all become speed readers. And he, you know, gives quotes, that one about Woody Allen, who did this, you know, speed reading and read, you know, War and Peace. And, you know, he summed it up. He said, it's about Russia.
Well, that's right. You distill things to their essence and they're not there anymore.
Right. His three takeouts I've got for us. Our to read pile, he says, don't see it as a bucket, but see it of books. But see it as a river of books flowing by us, of which we are grabbing the odd one. You know, if there's 3.5 million books in the British Library, how many will we read in a lifetime? A few thousand?
50 a year.
Times 50 years.
That's 2,500 or something.
Yeah, so you say you're right. You're going to read a few thousand. You and I will read a lot more. Because that's what we do.
We read parts of a lot more.
Yeah, and I read a lot, but I'm only going to read a tiny fraction of a fraction. And he says that there are 465 miles of shelving in the British Library. That's a long walk, you know. Anyway, so that first one, it's a river.
You know, there's one above the other.
I know, but there's a river flying by us, and we're getting the odd book every now and then.
Yeah. He says to have a bit of variety, just don't keep on reading the same thing.
Right. And he says, resist the urge to stockpile knowledge. He says, don't be like squirrels and trying to gather things in that are good for, you know, like if we go on to a quiz night, you know, where we want to have lots of knowledge. He goes, just read stuff and let it internally change you and shape you and just be happy with that. You don't have to, you know, try and remember it all. It's just the internal thing, what it does to you, which I like that idea. And he goes, and the third thing, he says, it's a present, you know, we're always saying let's live in the moment. And he goes, reading is living in the moment. It's a classic example where we are engaged and we're not thinking about anything else but the activity. We're in the flow of reading. And it's being like truly alive when we read books. We are in the moment. And he goes, so don't read to improve yourself, just read to be in the moment and enjoy what has happened to of all the beautiful books that happen to land in front of us.
Also, it'll prevent Alzheimer's.
There are many side benefits. Anyway, Mr. Berkman certainly got a big tick from me. I really enjoyed that. And let's quickly handle another one of the same thing, The Lost Art of Silence. Now, silence? Much silence in your life, Steve?
Hello, silence, my old friend. Time to talk with you again.
The Listener had a recent article about how annoying it was listening. I don't know if you saw it. It was an editorial about music in shops and in lifts and just the noise of the day-to-day life. And then there were letters, people going, we agree with this. It's a noisy, noisy place. And I was thinking, yeah, maybe Sarah's got something to say about it. And as I was mentioning before, she is a bookshop owner in Notting Hill, and it's a bookshop that specialises in travel books. Do you think you could, in a big city like London, you could have a bookshop just selling one thing?
You probably could if you became known as when everybody was contemplating going anywhere, and in a place like London where there are 10 million people or something, there's going to be 300,000 or 400,000 on any time planning a trip somewhere.
And they go to Sarah's shop.
Because she'll have
everything.
The Rough Guides and the Lonely Planets, as well as the Louis Theroux's and the Bill Bryson's and the...
And it would also, you know, your buying could be very specific. Many of us would have seen the bookshop because it figured in the Hugh Grant, Julia Roberts movie, Notting Hill?
Notting Hill.
Yeah. And there was a big scene or two or three in there, which is just a side. Anyway, she decided she would look at what the great writers thought of silence and thinkers and the sort of historians and the musicians and the artists. Everybody's got an angle on it, and sort of celebrates the idea of it. Of course, many people don't like silence. That's not what they do. And in fact, rush to avoid if it's too quiet.
Well, you get used to it and to noises, and it can be a bit disconcerting when there aren't any.
Yeah. But I think it's like a maturity thing, is suddenly realise actually it's quite nice at times.
Pretty quiet where we live, you see.
Yeah, and she goes, many find that the silence is not the absence of something, but the presence of everything. And it's kind of like the...
Law.
No, you're like, I like that. That I wrote it down. That's good.
I don't think it's true.
No, it's because to be creative, some people like to work with music, but then you talk to them, you know, if they're painters and all that, they actually can't recall the music at all.
No.
But it helps them get in the flow of whatever they were doing.
It's like some kids can study listening to rock music.
Yeah,
I don't know how they do, but if you turn off the music, they don't learn anything.
I know, and well, and there's also the counter argument that there are certain sorts of classical music which is enhancing of learning and
Baroque or something.
Yeah, it'll be like that, you know. Sure. Which it's sold a lot of CDs. I don't kind of go with it. I think silence actually is good. Short chapters, lots of nice little subheadings, succinct writing. This is very, very readable. You know, it makes you think about deserts, you know, what silence they could be in like places like Antarctica, I imagine. I mean, there's sort of the natural sounds. Silent buildings. I don't know if you know, like going into big churches off-peak in big cities, often that can be really quiet. I always remember like the big cathedral down and down by the clocks in Melbourne, you know, across the road, and you go into that. That's always quiet as, and the whole city.
I was worried about being struck down.
Prisons, you know, in solitary confinement. I mean, there's the dark side of it. Anyway, I thought this wasn't bad if you were interested in the idea of it. And there are a lot of books these days about, you know, calm and all that sort of stuff and being, you know, finding yourself a little bit in quiet places. And some people really structure it into their lives. Sarah's into that. And just the way it's written, I think you'd at the end of it, you'd have a pretty good handle on what's, you know, some very interesting people have done to actually create silence in their life.
Yeah, but they're all librarians.
Exactly. Right, The Lost Art of Silence, yes.
So I've brought along some new books, but this one I'm going to talk about, David Baldacci, A Calamity of Souls, is not that new. It was earlier this year. Now, Mr. Baldacci is extraordinarily prolific and somewhat confusing for booksellers because he writes Amos Decker, Aloysius Archer, Atlee Pine, Will Robey, John Puller, and some other ones, all different heroes.
Series.
And I never know what fits in with what.
Like Jack, everybody knows.
Yeah, exactly.
Jack.
Yeah.
And 27 so books later, it's still Jack.
Yeah.
But now when there's been like 11 different
people and they're all different. Yeah. But he's also written some standalone ones, and I read this.
Does he put as many books as Patterson, James Patterson?
I don't know how many James Patterson puts out. He's got his name on a few.
I know, but I mean, these guys are prolific.
He seems to write probably four a year.
Good.
Yeah.
So if you're a fan.
Yeah, well, you can be a fan of some and not others, I suppose. I haven't read that many. In fact, I haven't actually. Truth be told,
no. But you,
the first
you
one said, I read was The Camel Club, which was in about 1976 or something.
But that
was a spy novel,
right? That's 50 years ago.
Yeah, this is not. This is kind of a, I don't know if he did it on purpose, but a sort of a homage to Kill a Mockingbird. So it's set in the American South in 1968, and it is a kind of a whodunit and a legal thriller. The protagonist is a lawyer who...
Atticus Finch?
Well, you would think. Atticus gets a few mentions in here. But this guy, Jack Lee, is a self-employed, not very successful lawyer.
Jack Lee, Harper Lee.
Yeah, well...
Oh, it's fitting. I can see it now. Yeah, I'm liking the pitch.
Yeah. But he is, by default, the only lawyer left standing, forced to effectively provide a defence for this black man who's been accused of murdering his white employers. And this is set in, I can't remember the state, anyway, somewhere in the Deep South in 1968.
Okay.
So it's a long time after To Kill a Mockingbird, but the actual situation hadn't changed.
68 is Vietnam.
Vietnam gets a mention.
It's flower power, it's the whole the guy set, Hyde Ashbury, it's all there.
The guy who was accused of the murder was wounded in Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
Jack's brother was went to Vietnam, became a conscientious objector and never came home. So it's all that stuff.
Hey, but that actually, can this guy write?
Yeah,
I mean, 50 books or whatever it is down the trail, I mean, he knows the craft.
Oh, he does. And this is really well constructed. As I said, it's a bit of a legal thriller, a bit of a whodunit. And as I think I said to you, I didn't see the end coming. And I've read a lot of these, and I can always know who did it.
All right. Well, I'm making a note of that.
Yeah.
A calamity?
A Calamity of Souls, it's called.
Okay. No, because I happen to live with somebody who, and she loves legal thrillers and legal settings. So,
well, I could have given him my reading copy, but I read it in Brisbane and I left it with my little boy when we went over there.
It doesn't matter. You'll be back in Brisbane and you'll see it in a pile and you'll go, I'm saying, I'm bringing that back for Gareth. Okay. Got that. Let's. There's a big book over there. Let's just talk about that for a minute.
Well, I brought this along for you because the only cookbook we've ever done. Stop that. Stop wiggling around.
There we go.
Done on the show was Recipe to Neats by old Nagi.
Nagi Mahashi?
Yeah.
What a star.
And this is book two.
I know. And the first book, biggest selling book in Australia, non-fiction or fiction, broken all the records, absolutely just was a phenomenon.
Only cookbook ever with starring a golden retriever.
The Dozer.
Yeah.
And it became a hit in our family, and it became a hit in lots of families. We bought, I think, 5 copies of the original one as gifts. We already have 2 of this one. The world we live in, social media, you sort of keep an eye up suddenly for her stories. We get email books from her with, sort of personalised to Gail about, stuff. And
she knows what she's on about.
Fangirl of this. And
apart from that and her...
Well, here's the stat. In the first one, Gail, she takes notes on everything. She's done 35 recipes.
Right.
I mean, who does? Normally we do...
One or two. And just look at the pictures for the rest.
And dream that, man, that looks good, but, who cares? 35, and she's already done 2 from this book, and it's only been out about two days.
Yeah.
The recipes are manageable. Even I have performed 1 or 2, and that is significant. The tone, the style, the presentation are terrific. Our little neighbourhood we are in are all big Nagi fans. We talk about the book endlessly and talk about the recipes, and it is we're all a little over the top with the Nagi.
Well, yeah.
And good luck with this. I hope that it walks off the shelves.
Yeah,
and
the flavours and. And that's the key to these things. They're not very complicated, really, and the flavours are great. And she's pretty right. This one,
and everybody tweaks them. You all tweak,
because you haven't got half the stuff. But you can, that something will be similar.
I know. No, it's. I'm going to watch this with interest.
I don't know if that'll turn around, but there's Dozer.
Oh, yeah. No, he's the CEO of the company, by the way, and it's got a very funny photo at the back of the staff, posing, and then another photo, the next page is like the real staff, how they really look like. Yeah. You go back a few pages.
It's quite cute, this one here. Take that, Kale. He's looking disdainfully at this green curly stuff.
Yeah, no, they... Totally, look, has the heads up, and, it's a goodie. Okay.
You go.
Matt Haig, what do we know? Now, here's a book that I saw in Elmo's.
Yes.
Matt Haig, and with its pretty sharp cover.
It's a great shade of blue. I can find that on the shelves.
Ultramarine.
Is that what that is?
That's exactly what that colour is. There's a lot of blues, but that's ultramarine, and... The Life Impossible, Matt Haig. Great cover. This is a little bit of a love letter to Ibiza. Now, how do we know Ibiza? It's in the Balearics.
Yeah.
It's the bottom island.
Not many tops to the bikinis.
It's the party town. And it is... and what's interesting, actually, in places like the party towns, and what I discovered, like when we were in Crete, is that... The party towns, the serious ones, where they have the Brits send their police people in for the party seasons or on for the weekends.
Mm.
So to manage the Brit tourists who are, so the bobbies know how to handle them because they tend to rub the local... police.
The local constabulary who have guns.
The wrong way, that's right. But once they see a friendly bobby who speaks really good English,
and only has a truncheon.
Exactly. They look like PC 49, and that's throwing us back. Anyway, The Life Impossible, it's a story about a woman who gets given a house. Retired math teacher Grace is left a rundown house in a Mediterranean island by a long-lost friend. Curiosity gets the better of her, and she arrives and I beat her with a one-way ticket, no guidebook and no plan. Among the rugged hills and golden beaches of the Balearics, Grace searches for answers about her friend's life and how it ended, and she uncovers it's more stranger than she could have dreamed. But to dive into this impossible truth, Grace must first come to terms with her own past, where, you know, with this tiny, smaller spoiler, the loss of her son, of which she blames herself. And so she's carrying this burden and into the situation. Now, there's a little bit of interesting writer. He sort of draws us into some interesting thinking. So it gets slightly, like his book's slightly magical, but you kind of go with it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a little sad in places, but there's empathy for life and kind of the magical dimensions out on the edges. I'd start with Midnight Library, which you will have in stock. And if you like that, then continue. There are other books.
He wrote something in the middle, a little book, a sort of a self-helpy thing.
There's The Humans.
Yeah,
there's Notes on a Nervous Planet, Reasons to Stay Alive, The Comfort Book.
Yeah, that one. That's what I was thinking of.
Which I picked up and liked. I like him. Yeah. He's a little different. And it is good to say the magical stuff can be, but you sort of buy into it because there's so many good cultural references to how we, you know, what we notice and live that you go, actually, I'm okay with that. And imaginative. It's more like that's imaginative magic realism, of which there is quite a genre in itself. Midnight Library and The Life Impossible, Elmo's have them, get a big tick from me. Okay, some more fiction.
Okay, so what I've done is just picked up some stuff that just turned up, just to give our multiplicitous viewers a bit of a heads up as to what's coming in.
These are all potential stocking stuffers. And, Christmas is not that close.
No, it's not, but all the publishing goes on in October and November. Which I sort of find a bit irritating because there's the rest of the year when people might want to read something. And so this is Ian Rankin, Midnight in Blue. This is a John Rebus thriller. So if people have read...
He started a lot of... I mean, he was the first of the sort of perhaps the compromised hero who's got issues. And
yeah, Rebus had major, major, major issues. And there's... I can hardly count them, but there's probably over 20 of them.
See, I haven't read them. And people look at, you know, mates who like this sort of book go, what, you haven't read them? And I go like, I'm worried that if I like it too much, there's 20 of them.
Well,
and that
just,
would be a huge
read one a year.
Hunk.
Just about see you out.
Man, if I got 20 years, I'll take it. Yeah, okay. All right, anyway, tell me more about the latest.
I was quite surprised because I thought that he was probably dead, Ian Rankin, but it turned out when he wrote his first book 20-odd years ago, he was only about 36. So he's still, in author terms, quite a young person. Like, you know, Ruth Rendell, she was 93 or something when she shuffled off and still writing.
Right, because a lot of them are not that flash in the later years.
You get that.
Yeah. But the Rankin, I mean, he's solid, isn't he, all the way? Everybody, the fans are going to chew this up. I mean, you have readers who they just can't.
Yeah, they come and say, wait, this is what I'm here, just telling people that it's here. John Ricks.
They set in London or are they up north?
No, he's in Edinburgh.
So he's
at this point, the last couple, he's been retired, probably not entirely voluntarily, because he had a way of, well, we've had a little bit of a New Zealand at the moment recently where the police have pretty much decided who the bad guy was and made the facts fit the supposition and it turned out they were wrong. Well, he's done a bit of that, probably in a drunken stupor.
I think every police person probably
has a touch of that every now and then.
But yeah, so that's why he probably retired early-ish. Says here, John Rebus spent his life as a detective putting Edinburgh's most deadly criminals behind bars. Now he's joined them.
Okay, that's a different angle.
That is, until a murder at midnight in a locked cell presents a new mystery, they say old habits die hard. So this is a case where the prisoners and guards are all suspects and everyone has something to hide. Rebus walks a tightrope with his life on the line. How do you find a killer in a place full of them? So it's interesting.
That's concept. That is a great pitch.
Yeah, he's a good writer.
Maybe if I started at the end and read his latest, or do I need to know all the backstories?
Well, I reckon it's really interesting if you start at the beginning and just, especially with someone who, if that was their first book of any kind, who's just to see how the
how he evolves.
Mm. I think you can see. The first few Jack Reacher novels, you could see him craft improving in the last half dozen. He just kept on writing the same book in a different place. But you know, they changed that now because he's getting his brother to write them. But,
right, a bit more energy in it.
Yeah. So that's Ian Rankin.
The Ian? Yeah, no, it's it's kind of like those Kate Atkinson.
Yeah, so there's a new one of those. Have we talked about that? There's a new Jackson Brody.
Yeah, and that's... So I'm behind the eight ball. That's another series. There's like five Jackson Brodies.
Yeah, but they've come out over a longish period of
time.
They
have, yeah. And I like Kate.
Yeah.
Was I don't know much about the Rankin, but I don't hear anyone ever say anything bad about them. They go like... And I've been to Edinburgh. I know Edinburgh reasonably well.
Yeah, and it's pretty evocative.
I've been
to Stirling. I haven't been to the big Scottish cities.
When I get through a couple of series, like the C.J. Sanson, and I'm pretty well done with Mick Herron, I've pretty well read all those, I'm moving into Kate and Ian Rankin.
Yeah.
You heard it here. Okay. Next.
Similar sort of situation, really. So we have a new Anne Cleves. She's probably our biggest-selling crime writer. This is a new Vera. See, people know she's done a 3 series. So there's a Vera, which was Brenda Blethard was on the telly. I think she's stopped doing it because, although she looked about 60, apparently she's 80-something.
Oh, my goodness.
So she didn't want to do it anymore. My favourite TV really is because she's such a quirky, complicated sort of a character, and she just did a brilliant job of it. But Anne Cleves writes these police procedurals, really. Mm. So she's done the Vera series set in Newcastle, the Shetland series set, obviously in Shetland, and then the
which I did like.
Yeah, and then
Perez,
and then the one set down in Somerset with. Can't remember his name. Another different detective, Matthew. Yeah. Doesn't matter. So she's writing these 3 series, but she's turned out a few Veras lately. So the thing I did a pretty good job on the TV programs as well, is that you start with a crime, and then the police try and work their way through the thing, and there's always half a dozen really obvious.
Yeah.
People who would have done it, and it always turns out it was someone else completely, and they just waste so much time.
As you do, yeah.
So, and I think that if you're a policeman trying to solve a crime, that must be how it is.
Yeah.
It's not always like...
I think you just kept arresting people and interrogating them, you know, beating them up until they confess.
Until one of them confesses.
Yeah, and then you're just, you know, moving on. Or maybe that's another sort of country, but...
Anyway, so that's...
And who didn't love Shetland? I mean, I thought it was just like shot by the tourist board, actually, and showing us the little islands, and, you know, there was a story that sort of thread through with Jimmy Perez solving all the crimes.
Mm.
Great stuff. All right, now we it's a, but hey, that's another one, another series, you see. Now, Rankin, Atkinson, Cleves.
Yeah.
That's a lot, a serious amount of books.
It's a lot of crime as well.
I need to Desert Island.
If you read them all, if you read one of each of these writers a week, you'd be a seriously depressed person.
Yeah. No, it's but on a desert island, there'd be one to take. A sample of each.
Yeah, I reckon, because no one can get you there.
That's right, yeah. And you won't you know, get depressed on a desert island because it's like margaritas and hammocks. It's all good. French books. Now, don't laugh. Look, this, look, I found this in the library. Antoine Lorraine.
Have a look, see how many people have taken it out. Do they still do that in the libraries?
No, actually, it's pristine. But hold it, it was published this year.
Okay.
And Antoine, award-winning author of novels including The Red Notebook and The President's Hat. His books are translated into 25 languages, and he has sold more than 250,000 copies in English. And they... And why I've got this is I'm going to pitch it to the book club. Because, A, it was a good book. And as it says on the cover, Five Floors, One Murder, Let the Therapy Begin. And it's the therapist who lives opposite this building, and a woman comes in for therapy, and she says... I'm a photographer and all that and thing, but I've photographed a murder in the building across the way. And he goes, well, and she's unhappy and anxious and depressed and all that. He says, well, why don't you write of what happens on each floor, because you watch them all the time, and we'll use that as the basis of our therapy. And so now we have like five chapters.
It didn't occur to her to just mention this to a policeman.
Well, he's not sure if it really is, you know, like what did she actually see and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, my little notes on it, great cover, you know, very, very good. And the flyleaf, Nathalia Guitry was a successful photographer until the day she caught a murder on camera. She's got a creative block. And writing the stories may unblock this. Starting with her actor-turned-YouTube life coach on the ground floor and going all the way up to the fifth via the cartoonist and financial trader, Natalia creates vivid accounts of her Parisian neighbours' lives. But are her tales real or imaginary? As their sessions play out, the doctor becomes increasingly uncertain. So it's great,
yeah.
And it's a great little take. And looking at the little book, I mean, and how Gaelic does that look? I mean, the author, he even looks like a guy that you would see sitting, you know, with pastis and olives, you know, in a boulevard. And
do you mean Gaelic rather than Gaelic?
Gaelic. Garlic. I don't think Gaelic. Gaelic?
Gaelic would be Irish. Gaelic would be French.
Gaelic. That's why I have you here, Steve. You pick me up on this stuff all the time. It's very good. Anyway... And this is my pitch to my book club. It's going like, this is really good. And this, what we'd do, because there's like nine of them, we could all take a different one or whatever we can find and access, and then report back and have a session, you know. And then we have a French-themed party, which we like to do in our book club. Mm. And it'll be great. It's a winner.
Because that's wine, cheese.
Very cinematic.
Bread. Stuff like that.
And very French. And then I asked myself, what does it mean when I say this book is very French? So I wrote it down. It's set in Paris. Very good.
Okay.
Good. There's lots of cafes and lots of pastis and olives to think about. It's philosophical. It's smart, sharp, and witty, which I kind of like. French writers are good at that sort of stuff, like their movies. It's elegant. That works. Sophisticated. I mean, my French women tend to dress up, you know, even if they're going up to the letterbox, they look fantastic. And so anyway, it's French.
No onesies.
It's a mystery and a comedy. I would call it, I wouldn't call it actually, somebody called it a literary souffle. How's that?
With murders.
With a murder. With a certain possibly. Charm. That you warm to the charm of it, and it's kind of... Can you see my pitch to the book club working?
When you said the nine of them, is that like nine different books?
Yeah.
How are people going to find the other eight?
Well, I think they go into the library catalogue and they'll find five. So they're not going to find all nine, but you see, the trouble with a book club is how do you access the book? Especially when it's a like this might be the only book in the 40 catalogues that our library sort of has. But I know the president's hat's in it, and I know, and some of these look really good, and which I like. Then I put it in my little list when I go, you know, to bookshops around the place. I have a little list I pull out to sort of say, do you have this?
Mm.
You
know, and inevitably people say, no.
Never heard of it. But you know, when you find it, it's like the biggest thrill ever. Anyway, that's my pitch to the book club. I think I can get the ladies in the book group on board. I think they'll go for this.
That's because of the French wine.
The whole elegance thing. They'll buy into that. And I reckon, and the guys will go, man, that's slim. Because we're big readers.
Yeah.
And getting a book like this is way better, you know, than the Barbara Kingsolver, you know, Demon Copperhead or something, yeah. Which was like that.
Yeah, it wasn't hard to read, though.
No, great book. But anyway, that's my French windows. I think it's a winner. Anyway, to conclude, we're going to go into a book that Velda,
yeah,
who used to sit in this desk and hit the buttons, she loved his first book.
Yes, it's these sort of eco-literary tour de forces. Richard Powers won the Pulitzer for Overstory. This is a book called Playground. Just turned up. I haven't read it, to be fair, but I just thought I'd mention it in case there are people out there who like books about what appear to be whales. Raffi and Todd are two polar opposites at an elite high school where they bond over a 3,000-year-old board game. It sets them up for life. Elsewhere, Evie, I think it's a French name, Beaulieu, I can't pronounce that, sinks to the bottom of a swimming pool in Montreal, strapped to one of the world's first aqualungs. You know, Aroita grows up in naval bases across the Pacific with art as her only home. All of these people meet on the history-scarred island of Makatea in French Polynesia, marked for humanity's next great adventure, a plan to send floating autonomous cities out into the open sea. As the seasteaders close in, how will Evie play the ever-unfolding oceanic game? So I mean, there you go.
He's a kind of heavyweight, you know, of this type of, you know, it's kind of like you've got to be, like, really bright.
Mm.
Like Dr. Velda would just, you know, be catnip to her. But, you know, can I read that? I mean, is that just looking at that?
Well, you'd have to care about whether the planet lives or dies.
I'm not going, look, I've got green credentials, but some of the stuff is kind of tough.
Yeah, I don't. Well, no, it's not hard to read.
Okay.
Whether you'd accept the premise.
Yeah.
Is
It's about our capacity to care. There's a lot of stuff to care about.
Yes.
You know, and what do you choose?
Are you better to spend your time caring or just reading?
Well, yeah, that's the problem. You see, now you've seen me, you've exposed me. It's like I can push that stuff aside because the lure of the printed word in a great book just wins every time.
Hmm.
Anyway, hey, that...
So that's Playground by Richard Powers, and I'm sure there'll be lots of people beating a path to our door to find out how you can build a city and float it across the Pacific, hoping the wind doesn't get up.
There was a Kevin Costner movie, Waterworld.
Waterworld.
Yeah. I know, that was... Maybe she stole that idea.
Yeah.
Mind you, that was a pretty... That was...
That's kind of the opposite, wasn't it? These people were kind of stuck out there, and there was this rumour that there was some dry land somewhere, and they went off to try and find it.
Yeah. Great movie. I don't know why it didn't sort of
I don't
fly.
Know why people laugh about it. I thought it was quite good.
I did too. Hey, that brings us to the end of the October show. We've looked at a variety of books. I do encourage you to visit Elmo's, where Steve and his wonderful staff and Rosalie will look after you, and they will even catch them at the right moment, gift wrap your books, as they have done for me. Is that just me? Am I the only person that's ever had it gift wrapped?
No, if people make it pretty clear that they would intend to give the thing away to someone and they say, I'm just on my way to the party now, which often happens with kids' books on Saturday morning. You're not the only one. But not everybody gets a bow, because if I'm there, there are no bows.
Hey, look, thank you from Steve and I. You can find this program on Elmo's Facebook page, and we look forward to catching up with you in November.